resolved, everything went into motion to help Emil put together the first statewide meeting. Emil reminded me the other day that Pionic paid hotel bills, taxi fares, plane fares, and did quite a bit of the legwork to put together the first meeting. I was here while Emil was working out of a little office up in the Pionic building, having been repurchased by the village. And Emil thought, oh, there might be a few people show up to this first meeting, and he was totally amazed at the turnout and the results of that first meeting. So we're proud today to be able to remind you that Tionic helped to get started the great organization known as the Alaska Federation of Native. Just a little added note, Tionic as a former reservation had the option to choose whether or not to share at any other village under the land claim settlement, that is to receive land and monies, or they could have opted to accept service and subservice to the former Milwaukee and then forego all other benefits. That was another tough decision. People went ahead and enrolled because they had to enroll regardless of how the village people were going to vote. So the people who enrolled to Tionic voted, since they had always wanted to share with everybody else, with their brothers and sisters, that they would continue to do so. And so our village voted to become a village as any other under the land claim. And we're very happy that we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Agnes. I forgot to mention that Agnes is also a board member of the Cook-Inlet region. Another thing happened in the mid-60s. That was the formation of the Thunder Times under Howard Rock. He gave us unqualified editorial support. His paper had a national and statewide audience. He got the paper started when he met a man named Dr. Henry Forbes. He put money into the Thunder Times for, I would guess, 10 years to keep it afloat until it finally became self-supporting. One of the big issues that Howard dealt with besides land claims was they were going to use an atomic bomb to blast a deep water port up on the northwest coast of Alaska. And that was the first issue that Howard dealt with. And I have to say, from what I know, that it was mainly because of his efforts in editorializing against it that did not happen. Now let me tell you about AFN and some of the organizations that joined to form the Alaska Federation of Natives. But first I have to tell you that the man who was key in many of these organizations was Nick Gray. Nick Gray was an Eskimo from Nome. He was one of the most articulate men I ever had the pleasure of listening to. And he had a great command of the English language. And he used it to organize people around the state. He dreamed of a statewide organization. Nick was instrumental in forming FNA. He then moved to Anchorage and talked to people on the street and tried to get them out to meetings. And finally, the results of his work was the Cook-Inlet Native Association. At CINA, we used to hold fundraisers to send Nick around the state. He attended AB conventions. He went to Cordova and to Bethel and wherever he was requested, he was willing to go. That was a time when KANA and NANA and BBNC and CRNA and LU League were being formed. They were formed mainly around on social issues, jobs, education, housing, and health care. It took the land issue to bring them all together. Now that we had regional organizations, the stage was set for the statewide struggle for land ownership that was to follow. You heard from previous speakers of the competition for use of land that came when the state started selecting their entitlement. That's what caused Native people from around the state to protest land selections by the state and others. Then in January of 1966, Bob Bennett, who was area director of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Juneau, was sworn in as commissioner of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. He was required to give the Senate Interior Committee a 90-day report. He devoted half a page to Alaska. He stated that the Bureau of Indian Affairs was drawing up the final solution to the land problem in Alaska. That was in April of 1966. In July of 1966, I wrote letters to about 15 people around the state suggesting a meeting to discuss the BIA action. If the BIA was going to draw up a final solution, then if we had any rights in land, we should have something to say about it. Howard Rock got a hold of the letter and gave it front page support. The result was 300 people who met one block from here in the Tyonic building. We agreed at that meeting to form a statewide organization. After 3 days, we elected Floyd Lackenoff as chairman to write bylaws for that organization. Nick Gray lived long enough to see the beginning of his dream for a statewide organization. During the second day of that first meeting in 1966, Nick came from his hospital bed to talk to the convention and to visit. He looked tired. I suggested that he should take it easy and get some rest. He looked at me and said, "Emil, as long as I'm in a race, I'll run until I break the tape." About 3 weeks later, he died. I chaired that first meeting, and one of the most important committees that we sent out was a land committee. Willie Hensley was appointed chairman of that committee. In January of 1967, we held a meeting in Fairbanks, which turned out to be our first confrontation with the state over land. At that meeting, Chief Andrew Isaacs made one of the most moving speeches I ever heard him make. And I remember him saying he remembers the first time he saw a white man, and he was a youngster. In April of 1967, we finally adopted bylaws for AFN, and we had an organization. I was elected as its first president at that time, and I took over full-time AFN and the land issue when we had $9 in the bank. Things have changed since then. In April of 1967, that position paper that was reported out by the land committee was introduced into the U.S. Senate by Senator Bartlett. It became Senate Bill 2020, the very first land claims bill. 8 bills, and 4.5 years later, the historic Alaska Native Land Claims Bill was law. During that period, we got the endorsement of the National Council of Churches. I see Walt Hayes sitting here. He and Fred McGinnis orchestrated the unanimous endorsement we got out of that group. There were 10,000 delegates in Cobalt Hall in Detroit. And on any one Sunday, they talked to 50 million Americans in their churches. So that was a significant endorsement. The AFL, we got the endorsement of AFL-CIO National Labor Unions and other Indian groups around the country. There was even a group of congressmen who called themselves Friends of Alaska Natives. In Alaska, it was a very hot issue. We were even picketed during a Senate hearing here in Anchorage. The Daily News supported us, the Anchorage Times opposed us. At one point, we laid claim to all of Alaska. We decided to settle for 40 million acres of land, and it turned out that everybody opposed us. We finally compromised, and and agreed to settle for 40 million acres of land when Governor Hickel agreed to support our position before Congress. At one time, Secretary of Interior Stuart Udall offered us 10% of all revenue from offshore oil as part of our money settlement. The jury is still out on whether that was a good offer or not, because so far as I know, no money has come from offshore oil yet. During that time, we were asking Stuart Udall through Stanley McCutcheon to set aside 40 million acres of land around villages to protect their land and the use of land and the ownership of their land. Giving us the strongest support he could, he decided that if he had authority to withdraw 40 million acres, he had authority to withdraw all of Alaska, which he did. The land freeze stopped all transactions. The state was stopped from selecting land. Homesteaders were stopped from getting titles to their homesteads. Airports were stopped, roads were stopped, docks were stopped, everything stopped. That put tremendous pressure on everybody. It wasn't just an Indian issue then, it was everybody's problem. And there was tremendous pressure to solve it. Udall said when he did it that he wanted to keep everybody's toes to the fire. The state of Alaska, under Governor Hickel, called the land freeze illegal and filed a lawsuit to have it lifted. Before the lawsuit could work its way through the courts, Hickel became Secretary of Interior, where he had to defend the legality of the land freeze as protector of Indian rights. An irony of it is that the lawsuit ended up in the law books as Hickel v. Hickel. Our case took on a new stature when a former Supreme Court Justice, Arthur Goldberg, agreed to represent us and associated with him former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. I can tell you it was a great feeling to be testifying before the U.S. Senate and have at one elbow former Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg and at the other elbow former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. And I can also tell you that few congressmen or senators ever attempted to argue any legal points with our attorneys. These men were with us through the final passage of the Act. Now, we've all heard people say that the United States government gave Native people of Alaska land. That's not so. We retained 40 million acres of land and gave the United States good title for 335 million acres. You've heard people say that the United States gave Alaska Natives $962.5 million. That's also not so. We sold those 335 million acres of land for about $3 an acre. You've heard people say that the United States only had a moral obligation, not a legal one, to deal fairly with the Alaska Natives. I, for one, am convinced that we have a firm legal claim to all of Alaska. You can get title to land in three ways. You win it in war, someone gives it to you, or you buy it. None of these things have happened in Alaska. We maintain that what the United States bought from Russia was a guarantee that they could rule Alaska without interference from the Tsar. And they also bought what few possessions the Russians had in Alaska that consisted of trading posts, and the stockades that those trading posts were behind. The Russians did not have dominion of Alaska. They had not penetrated much of Alaska, except to trade for furs. So here, 100 years after the exchange of money between the Russians and America, it was now time to deal with the owners of the land. Our legal claim was based on three things. One was the Treaty of Sessions with Russia, where the agreement said that the uncivilized tribes were subject to such laws and regulations that the U.S. passed from time to time. The second thing was the Organic Act of 1884, the first civil government for Alaska after 17 years of rule by the U.S. The act was passed at the insistence of miners who had no place to file their mining claims, The act said, Indians or other persons in said district shall not be disturbed in the possession of any lands actually in their use or occupation or now claimed by them. But the terms under which such persons may acquire title to such land is reserved for legislation by Congress. That's pretty strong language, and it's also straightforward. Those of you who were around in 1967 and 68 will know what I say when, know what I'm talk about when I say that even LA lawyers who become attorney generals should be able to understand that. The third legal leg for our argument was the state of that. When the people of Alaska agreed to join the Union, there was a condition to join it, insisted upon by Congressman Edmondson of Oklahoma. He insisted on the language that said the state, that in the language of the state of act that said, the state and its people forever disclaim any right or title to lands, the right or title to which may be held by Eskimos, Indians, or aliens, or held in trust for them. This is part of the legal argument that saw us through Congress with the most successful settlement in history. No matter how just our cause or the legal basis upon which it was founded, none of this would have happened without people. Let us remember some of them. Of course, I'll not remember them all. Some are along with us. Alice Brown gave money and unqualified support for our efforts. Larry Skolkoff did the same thing. When AFN had no money, Fred Motti took a single engineer plane from Anchorage to Unalakleet, Nome, Kotzebue, Fairbanks to pick up people for a board meeting, and 2 days later he backtracked and dropped those people off. As far as I know, he donated his time and equipment for that trip. Harvey Samuelson never missed a meeting, even when he took time off from work and paid his own fare and hotel bills. Frank Degnan fought hard, never wavered in his belief. Oscar Craig served only a short time before he died. And just to list a few of the others, Tony Lewis, Jerome Craig, Walter Soboff, many people in rural CAP that I don't know. Many people in the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission. Don Wright was president of AFN during the last hectic year before passage when I decided it was time for me to step aside as president of AFN. Thus, nearly five-year struggle for the act took a great deal of effort, hard work, and sacrifice. There were those who said it was impossible. There were even threats made. But Native people throughout the state made their personal contributions. As we celebrate the 10th year since successful passage of the Act, let us renew our commitment to work together, knowing that we can meet any challenge that the future holds for us. Thank you.